I'm Julia LaRoche, and this is Yahoo Finance Presents, What It Takes. Today, we're joined by private equity pioneer Steven Schwarzman, the CEO of the Blackstone Group. He comes from humble beginnings, and he went on to build one of the most successful and largest private equity firms. Today, we take a look back at his career. We also talk about his engagement with world leaders, including President Trump. We get his thoughts on global trade and the economy, and of course, talk about his philanthropy. Take a listen. We're at Blackstone with CEO Steven Schwarzman, the author of What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Now, Steve, in many ways, you're representative of the American dream. You are on the Forbes list as the 100th richest person in the world. You've built one of the most successful asset management companies and one of the biggest. Yet you're sort of an unlikely story. You're the son of a dry goods seller. You grew up in a middle-class background. You went to a public school. So I have to ask you this. If you were starting out today, would you have what it takes to gain the same level of success?
Well, you never can predict exactly what your path would be when you start. I was born at a time where, you know, it was easier than it is today. I was the second year of the post-World War II baby boom. So there weren't many people ahead of you. So I think I probably could have figured out a route in today's world, but it was definitely easier when I was going to junior high school and college and getting my first job.
Now, I'm just reading about you, even when you were in high school, you were always a leader, or when you were in college or in the Army or starting out on Wall Street, you always took up these leadership roles, addressed problems. Was that something that was natural to you, or did you learn that quality?
No, it was natural. You know, I always liked to be in charge of something or lead the way or fix something that was not optimal or broken. And it was comfortable. I sort of always wanted things to work well. And so when I saw something that wasn't, you know, I could talk to the principal of the school or, you know, sort of the colonel in the Army or, you know, the dean of another university department. And I always felt I was doing something that was good, you know, for people I worked with. And I just liked that kind of role.
You know, something else that really stood out to me is that you wrote letters to people. You would write letters to business leaders, and they would actually sometimes invite you into their homes and have discussions with you. So do you experience that today? And do you find that young people are reaching out to you? And do you find ways to give back to them?
Yeah, I have like a steady stream of people. Sometimes when I go places, somebody will come up and hand me a note. You know, could I talk to you? Or I'm sort of at a point in my career where I could use some advice. And I try to do as many of those as I can, but I can't do them all. So there's a randomness to it. But none of us become successful because it's just us.
Right.
Everybody needs someone to support them. Everybody needs, in effect, a mentor, or more than a mentor. And so relying on other people helped me, you know, sort of wend my way to wherever I've gotten. And I think that we all have an obligation to other people to help them on their journey as well.
When you started on Wall Street, this was a funny story you told. You caught the attention of senior leaders early on at Lehman Brothers. Lou Glucksman yelled at you for not sitting up straight. And he later learned a lot of good things about you. Wall Street was smaller then. Do you think that's still the case now, that young people can stand out early on amongst their senior leaders?
Well, I think so. All of us in a more senior capacity are always looking around us to see who's got something special. Because if you're in any kind of, you know, vocation that involves human beings, you realize that people with real talent, real drive, you know, have that certain special quality. We call them tens. Nines are not so bad either. That they'll take you places. They'll develop things that you haven't thought of. They'll have a sixth sense as they get older. And if you develop those people, it's great for them, but it's also great for whatever institution you're in, whether it's for-profit like Blackstone or a not-for-profit.
Steve, you just mentioned 10s. How do you find a 10? Like, what do you look for to find a 10? What does it take?
Well, it's part of interviewing. What you find is that after the age of 40, people are their reputation. So if you meet someone and you're a little under-impressed and everyone says they're amazing, the chance that they're amazing is actually quite high. But when they're younger than 40, 20s and mid-30s and below, it's a little more challenging because they themselves have been trying out almost different approaches and different presentation styles. So I like to spend time with people in unstructured context. Usually when I meet someone, they give me a resume. Usually buried in the resume is something like, the fourth grade, they were the, U.S. National Chess Champion or something that they really want you to talk about because it's so odd. And so I take that odd thing and I acknowledge they put it there and, what happened to you with that? And then, we can talk about almost anything. I'm trying to feel how smart they are, how stable they are, how curious they are. And usually you can do that by just looking into their eyes. And sometimes I'll walk in a room and talk about what I was just doing, if it's exciting, and if they recoil with fear because it's a different situation, they probably won't be able to handle things that come at them in an unpredictable way. What you want them to do is hold the table, to be pretty much of an equal, because they are. Mm-hmm. Just because you're senior, all that means is that you've had more experience. Doesn't mean that you're better than anybody that you meet.
Well, I know it's really difficult to get a job at Blackstone. I was reading some of the stats in the book. So I have to ask you this. Do you think if you're applying to a job at Blackstone that they would hire you?
Well, this is what I worry about because I don't think they would.
Why not?
Because my grades, I wasn't a summa cum laude or magna. I wasn't even a cum laude. So there are different modes of learning. I'm not so bad at some of this stuff, but it's not because I test to a degree that a lot of the people we hire. So I think it's important that we look at different factors here at the firm. The conservative way is always hire the brightest person. I think it's important to be involved in student government of some type or a club or something where you demonstrate leadership. I tend to like people who are athletes only because you can take pain. If you're a good athlete, you push yourself to a point where it's not pleasant.
Well, shifting gears, I do want to talk about the private equity business just broadly. But first, let's talk about interest rates because they've been incredibly low, and that's probably one of the most important metrics when it comes to your business. So what's your outlook for rates?
Well, it's hard to go much lower. And if you do, it's not particularly productive. Because in most countries' economic system, at the centerpiece are financial institutions, banks. And countries grow when they extend credit to people, businesses, and people. If their interest spread is so low, because rates are so low, that they have trouble making money, the way many in Europe do, then it hurts economic growth for the whole country. So there are, I view it as a law of diminishing returns as rates go lower and lower and lower. It also hurts people who save because they can't make much money either. So now in Europe, I guess about a third of the countries are negative interest rates. In other words, you have to pay them to take your money. Seems to me there's something wrong with that model. And those countries as individual countries aren't doing particularly well.
Well, people often ask you for advice, so what would you recommend in these sorts of situations?
Well, I think there are two things you can do. One is reform of an economic system. Another thing that you can do is use fiscal policies to spend more money to stimulate an economy, but just forcing rates down into negative territory, I don't see that as a particular path to glory.
Mm-hmm. When you started Blackstone in 1985, you wrote that you had two big tailwinds, the U.S. economy and then the unraveling of Wall Street. If you or even a young person were starting a firm like Blackstone today, do you think they'd have the same sort of success?
Well, there's a lot of ways to be successful. Today, there are other advantages. You have the chance of borrowing money, very cheaply. You have a huge number of new technologies where you can become an expert, where perhaps somebody isn't, and that's a path to success that didn't exist when I was younger. So whenever you have a big, robust economy and governments printing lots of money, you can usually get some money because there's so much around. And the changes in the economy, the structural changes, now vastly exceed anything than when I was younger.
Just 2 years into your career, you made what you described as one of the biggest investment mistakes, or the firm did, and someone, an investor, berated you and almost made you cry. And you often talk about failures as opportunities to learn. So what did you learn from that experience, and how did that change your investment process going forward?
Well, that was perhaps one of the defining moments of the firm and my career. We basically bought a company where two partners disagreed. One thought it was going to be a big winner. The other one thought it was going to go bankrupt. I picked the first partner. We didn't have any processes. We were just sitting in front of my desk. I thought I was King Solomon at the age of 38. Guess what? I wasn't. And we lost our money. And this was totally traumatic because it was our third investment. And one of our investors asked me to come in and basically started screaming at me. And in my family, nobody ever raised their voices. I never heard a raised voice in my household. So that makes me very sensitive to meaning when what other people are saying. In this case, this was like some bunch of speakers turned up to deafening, and I left this thing. I almost started crying as this guy was berating me with good reason. And I basically said, this is never going to happen again. We're going to come up with a different system. We're going to assess risk. We need something different. And so what we invented is basically what we use today, which involves a team doing a written presentation, listing all the risks among other factors, and giving it to a group of people to read 2 days before, so they actually don't get hoodwinked by somebody going with flip charts right in front of them. Mm-hmm. And then we get about, depends, different groups, different number of people. Just say, for example, you have eight people around a table and the team walks in, and basically part of the rule that we developed back then, it's adapted a little bit now, was that every person at that table has to recite, every person has to point out the risks and what the probability of those risks should be in their view, and how bad it would be if that happened. And it's not about watching one smart person interrogate a team and having seven others be a paid audience. Nobody's an audience. And if the people who bring the proposal realize that they're basically going to be intellectually filleted every time they come in the room, then it's never personal, because it happens every time. And it makes the team be much better prepared, and it makes everyone who's at the table much better prepared. And then there's always questions. You send them back. You do the same process again. And by the time you finish, we have quite a good idea of what the prospect of loss could be. If there's real prospect of loss, we don't do it. And then we price the deal, and if we buy it, it's not the fault of the team if it doesn't work out well. The reason it isn't their fault, about 90% of the time, it's one of those three variables, one of those three risks that happen, and we knew it was going to happen. But we didn't think it would really happen, or we didn't think it would be so bad. And so the team has the security of knowing that it's not their decision, and it's not even their assessment of whether we should go forward. It's all of ours. Mm-hmm. And so that way, it's very secure and fun here, and it's lifetime learning, and we're all exploring together. And that's what I learned. And that was the biggest change in our business. I realized I wasn't so smart. I needed everybody to make it work.
You said that psychology is one of your greatest strengths as an investor. Is that the characteristic that sets you apart?
That's really helpful, because my math isn't very good, as my brothers would tell you. And you know, I never got beyond add, subtract, multiply, and divide. But I can figure out typically what's on somebody else's mind. If you can figure out what's on the mind of the person who's opposite mm-hmm. you, then you can solve their problems pretty easily, unless what they're thinking is so unreasonable that there's really nothing to discuss.
Well, I do want to turn to your engagement, your public engagement. You know, in the book you talk about that you spend a lot of time talking to world leaders, and you're certainly no stranger to the White House. I mean, going back several administrations now. So as a business leader, what's your view on the current administration, specifically President Trump and his impact on the economy? Has he done a good job? Has he done a bad job? What's your assessment there?
Well, different people have different views. I guess if you're a Democrat, you have one view. If you're a Republican, another. I think the most important thing that was achieved was the reduction in regulation. And there are some other important things from a tax perspective. But that sets a stage for longer-term growth in a way that wouldn't happen if you hadn't made those changes.
You also talked about the strategic and policy forum, the business leaders that Trump had you put together. But after Charlottesville, that group disbanded, and it sounded like in the book that you had some regrets about that, specifically things that could have been done. Looking back, how do you think things could have been done differently, and what would have happened if the group stayed together?
Well, if the group was formed basically because the president asked for a small group of people who could tell him where he was going in the wrong direction and suggest other ways. And so it was meant to be an open forum where you could give input. If you didn't agree, fine. If you agreed, fine. And that's a precious kind of attribute to have in government, because usually when you disagree with the president or a prime minister, it doesn't matter which country, you can do that one or two times. By the time you do it the third and fourth, you become in less favor. Mm-hmm. So this was a good structural thing to have. Unfortunately, with the outcome of Charlottesville and sort of a number of the members who are running big companies, you know, like half of their companies had employees who were Democrats who were very unhappy with the president, and they were in effect putting pressure on the CEO. You have customers, you know, half of whom are Democrats, who were also putting pressure, and then there were also some Republicans who were unhappy. So, you know, I started getting contacts from the members saying, I'm under excruciating pressure here, and you know, I don't want to do this because it's hurting my business. And for me, this is an easy decision. Why should you do something that's hurting your business? This is supposed to be a good thing, not turn out to be a bad thing for you. And so we decided the best thing to do was to end the group. On the other hand, the purpose of the group was a good thing for the country because it was bipartisan.
Now, you also talk about that you've been involved actively in the trade talks. I know you've worked with business leaders and leaders in China. We've seen the trade tensions escalate. And since you've been involved in those talks, you also said that they're the most complicated you've ever experienced. Why is that? Why are they so complicated?
Well, it's been 2.5 years. And the reason why it's complicated is actually simple. That China, for the last 40 years, has grown more than any other country in world history. It's pretty amazing, but they've done it through a system, you know, where they have relatively closed borders, they have high tariffs, they have a variety of other practices which are not done in the developed world, like the United States and Europe and some other countries. And so given the fact that somewhere between 40% and 50% of the people in the United States are having a tough time economically, and they're unhappy with their government, the previous government, doesn't matter, and they want changes, and they're angry, and they should be. And so those people, after they've run out of people to attack in the United States for their unhappiness, they go abroad, and China's the target. And so China's where the jobs went, and China's where a lot of the wealth went during that period. So people want China to adjust. And China recognizes that that's what happened. There are a lot of people who just like it that way because it works. There are other people who recognize you just can't keep doing that with things getting relatively worse in the developed world. And so there needs to be an adjustment. People don't like giving up things mm-hmm. that they have. The United States would like to normalize all of these issues as soon as possible for China. So you've got something that's going to happen over the long term. And the question is, how fast does it happen? And how much of it happens. Mm-hmm. And so that's an area of tension as each one of these cultures decides what they're really willing to satisfy as a first step, because you're not going to get all this done. Nobody gives up the economic structure they've had for 40 years that's turned them into a winner because someone else asked them. But they're coming back to the table again, which is a good thing.
Do you think we'll get a deal? And when do you think we will get a deal?
Well, nobody knows that type of stuff. What's important is it appears that this is a serious engagement, and we'll see where it goes. I don't think there's anyone.
It's hard to handicap.
Who knows how to handicap it, except I think there's now a recognition on both sides that the decoupling of these two economies is really adversely affecting the world, global growth. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter which part of the world. And if you do that as a long-term strategy, that will have a depressing impact on global growth. And that's a net losing strategy. And so hopefully the fact that we're going into re-engagement is a recognition by the parties that, particularly by China, that this isn't in their long-term best interest either to decouple.
It kind of brings me to the Schwarzman scholars at Tsinghua University. And you wrote about how we could fall into the Thucydides trap if China and the U.S. cannot find a, quote, cooperative, trusting way to manage the shift in political power. How much does that worry you? You think about problems and things, and you worry sometimes. How much does that worry you?
Well, when we got the idea for this in 2011, it worried me then. But I must say, I was wrong. I thought this would take 10 or 15 years. It started happening 2 years ago, mm-hmm. In 2016. So it's pretty clear that with the tensions rising between, U.S. and China, and the developed world and China, that there's a real need to have some kind of buffer, some kind of a group of trained people who appreciate, the good parts of China, and there are many, and the parts that need to be modified, and can take a lifetime role thinking about those things and talking to the citizens and the 38 countries that they come from.
You've also given away hundreds of millions of dollars to philanthropy. A lot of it has gone toward education. Your former public school, I know some schools here in New York where you've sponsored students, Yale, MIT, the Schwarzman Scholars. But if you had to pick one area, where do you think you will have the greatest impact of all of those I've mentioned?
Well, that's like asking somebody about which of their children they really like. And the way I was raised, mm-hmm. you love all your children equally.
Right.
And so I can't give you a more perceptive answer than that. Each thing that I've tried to do, I think, is really, really, really mm-hmm. important for the constituencies that are involved.
But it also seems that the common thread is education. And how do you think that you can play a role in solving for education? Where do you see some of the dislocation, some of the problems that could be solved?
You know, it's important, and I try and support a variety of things to do this, and from individual students in the Catholic school system where we have 90% of them as minorities and 70% at the poverty line or mm-hmm. below, and 98% graduate, 96 go on to college. It's like an amazing set of outcomes. And you know, our great universities around the world can address certain types of problems. Like in China, we're trying to bring the world to China so that the world can understand China better. In the United States, you know, working on AI ethics issues, which are really going to be critical as people get a better idea of what's going on with AI. You were up at MIT with me, and we talked about those issues. I'm doing some of that at Oxford. And these are big challenges and opportunities facing us as human beings, as Americans, and international constituencies. So I like doing these kinds of big things. I've got a wonderful project at Yale where I think will change the way students relate and you know, have a central place to be, which I never had when I was there. So everything I do, I try and impact an important mm-hmm. problem or issue.
You know, one of the issues that a lot of your peers have brought up, I'm just thinking Ray Dalio, for example, has brought up capitalism and the need to reform capitalism. Do you think capitalism needs to be reformed, and what sort of role can folks like yourself play?
Well, I think capitalism needs to be reformed less, and education has to be made better. Mm-hmm. If we had a much more qualified workforce, then capitalism per se would work better. To try and get capitalism to fix an entire society is a good objective, and companies should do what they can for that, but there are different levers in our system that actually have to come into play to make it all work.
I only have a couple more questions for you. You have some simple rules in your book for identifying market tops and bottoms. I suppose this is a great framework for looking at where we are in the cycle. So right now, using those rules, where do you think we are and where do you see us heading?
Well, we're not at the bottom and we're not in the middle. So I think it's a time where U.S. is probably growing. I don't know. We'll find out retrospectively, but you know, somewhere around 2%, maybe a tiny bit less. We've got great consumers, mm-hmm. 70% of the economy, and manufacturing going down, and stock markets pretty much at records. So in you know, bond markets are sort of at records. And so usually when everything's doing records all the time, and there's a lot of geopolitical uncertainty, it's usually like a wake-up call. It's not red, but it's yellow. And it makes you be more conservative when you're investing. It makes you think more about downsides. It makes you want to buy higher quality things because your chance of accidentally being lucky, which happens at the bottom of a cycle, is much lower.
All right, Steve, you end your book with a question. You write, "What's next? Who knows?" So what's next for you?
Well, That's why I ended it
I
that
know.
Way.
Okay, fair.
And I think what happens, what I've learned in my life, is all you have to do is keep doing what you're doing, keep getting all the feeds from all the activities, whether it's Blackstone or my charitable stuff or things where I touched government. And what happens is you see something that you didn't see before. And that leads you to something big and something interesting. And I've learned all you have to do is be active and wait, and you'll see it.
Stephen Schwarzman, CEO of the Blackstone Group and author of What It Takes, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.